This week on Art of the Air features Bela Fleck, whose four-decade career has boldly gone where no banjo player has gone before, with a musical journey that's earned him 18 Grammy Awards in 9 different fields. His newest project plays homage to George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, plus we'll be sharing a preview of his next album coming in May. Our spotlight's on Indiana Ballet Theater's production of Cinderella running May 4th through 6th.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air, our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org, and Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on WDSO 88.3 FM. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. And we'd like to welcome back to Art in the Air Spotlight. We've had her many times before, but she's going to talk about their upcoming production of Prokofiev's Cinderella, and that's going to be May 4th through the 6th. It's at the main stage at IU Northwest in Gary. And, of course, the founder and artistic director of the Indiana Ballet Theater, Gloria Tui. Gloria, welcome back to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Thank you.
Aloha, Gloria.
So tell us about Cinderella. You have someone else choreographing this one, I think, this time. And you kind of, while you do shows over again, I don't know how many times you've done this Cinderella, but I think each time it's done is kind of a unique production, you know, sometimes different costumes and things. So, but tell us about this particular production.
Yes, each time, you know, because many people see it over and over again. So we do change the choreography from time to time. So a lot of the lead parts are choreographed by Amanda Tui, and she's my daughter, but she's also, you know, teaching at the Joffrey right now, doing all kinds of wonderful things with dance.
You've already had auditions for this or in the process of doing that. What ages do you look for? Is there younger kids in the Cinderella?
Yes, actually, it goes all the way down to the age of 4. So all the little mice that make Cinderella's dress for the ball are in this production. So we typically have about 100 in the production.
You started Cinderella over 25 years ago at the Star.
Oh, yeah.
So
yes,
there's been a lot of performances.
Yeah, it's one of the ballets. We have 9 ballets, but... that one is the longest running, other than Nutcracker. So,
do you have any outreach associated with Cinderella?
Well, you know, we bring in the guest performers. So we have Frederick Davis coming in from, he's coming in from Tennessee. And so then a lot of the leads are actually fairly local. Cinderella herself is Amber Mack, and she's from Valparaiso.
Yeah, your costumer, right? Your costume designer.
She also is a costume mistress, but she's also a full-time mother and nurse, so quite a busy lady. But they come to us, they never seem to want to leave, because they have such a good time.
You've done this at multiple venues in the past, but this year you're only doing it main stage at IUN. But maybe tell us about that, your experiences at the IUN and everything like that. And you're only doing it for, it looks like, one weekend, where you have done multiple weekends before.
We have, but we just find ourselves so busy with, you know, the building that we'll talk about in a few moments. But so IUN is very gracious to partner with us and keeping the costs affordable and making it possible to do that. It's difficult because, you know, Cinderella has a coach and large props that just won't fit on the majority of stages.
Right. Having done the musical version of it, I know the feeling. And the old rule in theater is if you build it for to be on stage, it's like a change of scenery. It has to live off stage at some point, too. So.
Yes, I'm usually the one that's designing the on stage things. And, you know, I went down to a very small coach when we did it at a hall last year. So the year before that, 2021, actually, it's the last time we did this. So. We did it in three different halls, and it was quite a challenge.
I'm sure. I mean, are you doing the full ballet, or how long does the performance go?
It's about an hour and a half, yeah.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the Classical Arts Center, which, you know, I've been in touch with you at some of the events you've done, and tell us about an update of the status of where you're at with that. And I know you're constantly raising money for it because, you know, you have a goal and so. And of course, with the new news that's come out about the hospital in Munster trying to get rid of the Center for Performing Arts, your place might become a really item in the Northwest Indiana.
Well, we're hoping so. And, you know, a lot of the vision for this is the fact that I came from England and I've seen it done over there, what they've done with renovating. And it's amazing. They've had theaters built by private entities that have gone on to join with the nonprofits to make a very successful arts facility. So this is what we're trying to do right there on 2323 North Main Street in Crown Point.
Right. And that used to be the, well, I guess it was the nurses' home for a while, and it served several, but it was basically kind of just sitting there vacant and not operation. Yeah. So it's great.
Right. It was vacant for 30 years before we took it over. So.
And what kinds of things are going to be in that building?
Well as ourselves, it'll be all of the other arts, visual and performing. And we've expanded on all of that now and thought of putting a 1,000-seat theater on the back end, which we hope will become another mini Star Plaza type for the region. And Northwest Indiana Symphony, 100% behind us doing that.
So, oh, I'm sure.
Yes.
Well, we have our final minute here. We want to give you a chance to talk about the dates, also your website and how people can find tickets and everything for your upcoming production of Cinderella.
And take classes.
Yes, that's true. We have classes and summer classes coming up. But May the 4th, it's from 1 o'clock and 6 o'clock performances. The 5th is at 2 p.m. And on the 6th, we have the field trip for the schools at 10 a.m. And they can go to ibtnw.org for tickets.
Well, that's Gloria Tuia from the Indiana Ballet Theater, Cinderella, May 4th through 6th at Main Stage, IU Northwest. Gloria, thank you for coming on Art on the Air Spotlight.
Thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure to see you.
Yeah, you too. Thanks.
And a Spotlight Extra, the 2024 Northwest Indiana Listen to Your Mother, a series of live readings by local writers about motherhood, will be presented on Sunday, April 28th at 3 p.m. at the Hobart Arts Theater. VIP and general admission tickets are available online at ltymnwi.ticketleap.com. Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Lakeshore Public Media is brought to you by McCauley Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Did you know that you can also listen to Art on the Air anytime as a podcast at Lakeshore Public Media's website, through Lakeshore's app, or from NPR? Plus, it's available on demand from your favorite podcast website, including TuneIn, Spotify, Amazon Music, Pandora, Apple Music, iHeartRadio, and many more. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode.
Hi there, this is Public Radio theme composer B.J. Lederman, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Bela Fleck to Art on the Air. Bela is widely acknowledged today as one of the world's most innovative and technically proficient banjo players. On a musical journey of over four decades, he is an 18-time Grammy Award winner in at least nine different fields. With his wife, Abigail Washburn, their self-titled album earned the 2016 Grammy for Best Folk Album. They followed that with Echo in the Valley. 2018 brought the induction into the American Banjo Hall of Fame. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Bela. I want to thank you both you and Abigail, for enriching my sonic landscape for so many years. Thank you.
Hey, thank you. I'm glad to have enriched. I've been enriched by many, so pass it on.
Mm-hmm. We hooked up with B.J. Lederman. We interviewed him, and we actually featured one of the things that you collaborated on his interview. So that was kind of
fun. That's fun.
Yes.
Yeah, that was kind of an out-of-the-blue thing. He just got in touch, and I was like, yeah, you really want to? Great. Great.
Well, how we like to start our show, Bela, is we like to get your origin story. And I always tee it up by saying, how you got from where you were to where you are now? So tell us all about Bela.
Well, I started out as a young child in New York City. I was born in Manhattan, I think on 120th Street, not quite Harlem. And then I grew up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan around 100th Street. And when I was five or so, I heard the banjo on the Beverly Hillbillies on television. And it rocked my world. I didn't know why. It made no sense. I had no cultural entering point. It just hit me. And so from then on, I was banjo aware. And whenever a banjo was around, I would be interested. I never had the nerve to think I could play one because it sounded impossible. But I took up the guitar in kind of a half-assed, you know, way, like kids who are like, yeah, I like the guitar, but I don't really want to practice. And I sang some Beatles songs and read the chord charts in the books back in those days they had. But then when I was 15, Dueling Banjos was out, and my grandfather said, oh, you like guitar? This is like a guitar. And so he found a banjo it was a deal. He probably bought a great lamp or something at a garage sale.
Banjo.
And he said, oh, what's that? Oh, well, I'll throw in this banjo with this lamp for, you know, for $20. So he shows up with this banjo. Well, maybe Bela will like it. So I show up to see him in upstate New York that weekend. With the weekend, I was 15, and it was the weekend before high school started. And there's this banjo. And I'm like, oh my God, there one is. You know, I've been loving this instrument for the last 10 years or however long, 5, 7 years, 10 years. Yeah. And there one was. And so suddenly it was in my hands. I was like, I can't, how can I play it? I gotta learn this thing. And then on the train ride home to the city, which is about an hour long ride, a guy walks up and said, hey, is that a 5-string? And I said, yeah. And he said, and it was like a bearded guy, hippie guy. And he said, want me to tune? Can you play it? I said, no. He said, you want me to tune it up for you and show you a couple of things? And so this guy on the train, it was not the subway, it was the Hudson Valley line, gets out this beater banjo and tunes it up for me and shows me a couple of things and hands it to me, and I'm off to the races. And I could not put it down for the next, 50 years. And that's basically it. Now, this was the 60s, early 70s. 15. Yeah, it was the early 70s. And so there's all kinds of great music happening in New York. And there was bluegrass that came through, you know, regularly, but I was also quite interested in everything else, the classical music, the rock, the jazz, the reggae, everything. So I just, I would always try to learn to play it on the banjo. And that's the short story of how I ended up being whatever the heck I am.
Were there any mentors along the way with banjo when you first picked
yes.
it up?
Yeah, I had three very, very powerful mentors. The first was a guy named Eric Darling, who played in a group called The Weavers after Pete Seeger left.
In
that group. And Pete Seeger left because The Weavers wanted to do a commercial for money, and they were going to get paid some good money to do this commercial. And he said, well, I'm out. If that's what you guys are about, I don't do I don't do commercials. So he left the band, and this guy, Eric Darling, joined, and he was a very talented banjo player. And He was in the Weavers after Pete. So he was my first teacher. And then after a while, he said, look, I think you need to learn this Keith style. So go to this guy, Mark Harwood. At that time, he was way out in Brooklyn, about an hour train ride. And so I would go out and see him after school and spend a couple hours with him and come home late. And he got me going. And eventually, he started playing me some recordings by a guy named Tony Trischka. And Tony was the most forward-thinking banjo player maybe ever, maybe even up to now. Had to change the banjo in more ways than anybody and brought it into a modern era. So anyway, it turned out he lived in the Bronx, and I started taking lessons from him. And he was probably the guy who gets the most credit for being my mentor, but I think all three of them played an incredibly big role. He just sort of, I was ready for him because of those other guys. And then he was able to point me in a direction that basically to continue to fulfill some of his ideas. So it's pretty remarkable. And I'm very friendly still with Tony Trischka, Mark Horowitz, and Eric Darling.
Did that mentorship start in high school? And did you have a band? Did you form a band in high school at all?
Yeah, this started pretty much right in high school. As I got my first banjo, I found my first teacher, and they sort of shuttled me on as I was going through high school. And by the time I got out of high school, I went straight into professional performing and touring with bluegrass bands, and eventually worked my way into some really great groups, and eventually left bluegrass and started working in the jazz world, or whatever you want to call the world is that the Flecktones lived in, which played a lot of jazz festivals and opened for a lot of rock bands and jazz bands and things like that.
How did the Flecktones come together? How do you choose who's going to be part of the Flecktones?
The Flecktones, sometimes these things kind of happen to you, and I've talked to other famous band leaders who've had great bands, and I consider Flecktones to be a great band. If I wasn't in it, it would still be a great, you know what I mean? It's not about me. It's just a remarkable pile of musicians with really creative points of view. But I was exploring the bluegrass world, and I was playing with the best people. And typically I would get them to record on a record for me and put them through hell trying to learn this stuff that was very alien to them. And they would say things like, too much brain, too many brains in this tongue, too many parts. It was kind of like, well, who was the guy who told Mozart that in the Mozart movie? It's too many notes.
Salieri. Yeah.
Yes.
I think it was Salieri talking for the king, but they were in on it together. But at any rate, then I met these guys over the course of the late 80s, and I would show them things, and they would go, do you have any more? You know, when I met Victor Wooten and Howard Levy and Future Man, they just sucked it up so fast. I was like, wow. And so I decided to go start playing with these guys and seeing what happened. And at the time, it was a real leap of faith because we were very unknown. I was only known in the bluegrass world. I wanted a jazz career at that time. But I had found a band that I thought were much more powerful than I could be with me in a backup band. It was going to be a band. We were all going to be equal in this thing. Just like Return to Forever, when I saw Chick Corea in the 70s, and he had Stanley Clarke and Al DiMeola and Lenny White in the band. They were all equals. Chick was the ringleader, but they were all equals. So I wanted to be in bands like that. And that's what bluegrass is all about. You don't have a bluegrass band without extremely strong players on every instrument.
Yeah, you stand together.
Vocals. Yeah, it's like a basketball team. It's you pass, you know, you score, you all take the credit together.
You know, the banjo has been sometimes regarded as a less than instrument sometimes, and I don't agree with that, but I mean, people kind of look at the banjo, oh yeah, you play the banjo, kind of like the accordion, but what's your defense of that? I mean, is that because of some of the roots of it that was a kind of an African-American bring over and everything, or just tell me your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, I think it's the opposite. I think if more people knew that it was an African-American bringover, they wouldn't be looking down on it so much. It's actually because it's a white Southern stereotype that the banjo is only that. And when I say only that, I'm talking about the image of the South that includes the Beverly Hillbillies, which, of course,
right,
I love despite the flaws. or dueling banjos, which, you know, includes a male rape scene. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And then the Hee Haw Show, where we're sort of making fools out of Southerners. So instead of thinking, wow, look at this instrument that has made it all the way from Africa through these black people's hands into modern American music in so many different ways, from the birth of jazz when it was an instrument in Louis Armstrong's earliest jazz groups and Jelly Roll Morton's groups, to the classic banjo era when people played all this incredible complex music on the banjo that you would call, you know, we would think of it maybe almost in a ragtime kind of world. And even a time when there were banjo orchestras in the late 1800s. before the guitar came and swept it away. And all we're left with is this idea that it was just a Southern white rural instrument.
Right.
Now, again, I have to say it's some of the greatest music that's ever been created, that Southern white bluegrass.
Sure.
So I don't want people to think I'm looking down on it or didn't. I think it's, I'm proud to be part of the bluegrass world. It's grown into such a diverse and inclusive community. I'm thrilled to be part of it. But the banjo is an African instrument, and it has much, much longer roots. This was all long before bluegrass was a gleam in Bill Monroe's eye. So, you know what I'm saying? So I just think people don't realize it, but I think it's quite a thing to be proud of. And the banjo is also kind of like a cockroach, that it keeps getting almost stamped out, and then it springs up somewhere else under your other foot or something and climbs back up and is the winner in the end.
And certainly your work has elevated the banjo to have a huge respectability and everything. And, you know, banjo was associated with minstrelly, and, you know, like my background is musical theater. So much of minstrelly eventually influenced modern musical theater, some of the things that we have in that. So
right. But one of the problems with the minstrel thing for black folks is that white people would, back in the early 1900s, would paint themselves black, get out banjos, and start singing about how great it was on the old plantation.
Right.
Now, would you find that offensive if you'd just been freed from slavery?
Of course. I understand that. Yeah,
I would.
And what was interesting, and I did this when I was working my doctorate, is that there were many black entertainers that put blackface on to become minstrel groups. I was surprised to come across that, and it was like, interesting. So,
but what you find, and I've interviewed folks, including Danny Barker, who was a banjo player from that time, is that as soon as the guitar showed up on a record, and he told me the record, I still have never been able to remember what it is. I could probably look it up. It was the first song that had guitar instead of banjo on it. And maybe, I don't know if this was the 20s or earlier. And everybody immediately went, let's get rid of that banjo. Let's play guitar. And all of the banjo players were out of work. Almost within a year, it went from banjo being on everything to all being guitar. And from then on, banjo was... And he tried to play banjo with Cab Calloway. He said the Vega Banjo Company had come to him and said, if you will play banjo on one song in the Cab Calloway show, we'll give you this free, beautiful banjo. And so he went to Cab, and Cab said, no, we've been trying to get away from that thing for a long time. You may not. And so it was, that just shows you how people looked at the banjo, black people looked at the banjo at that point.
When you did Throw Down Your Heart, when I watched that documentary, it seemed like a lot of Africa had forgotten about the banjo as well. It seemed like there was like genuine like wonder.
Well, you have to keep in mind that, like, they don't have the same feelings about it that American black people have about it, because they weren't oppressed the same way. Maybe the other different people oppressed them. You know, it's horrible, but I'm sorry. Gallows humor. But, so, like, when I got over there, they thought, oh, they had heard bluegrass. They maybe thought that's where, like, I would say, "Where do you know where this came from?" And they'd say, Kentucky? And I'd say, right here. So that was, but there were a lot of people in certain countries who did know. For instance, in the Western African countries like Mali. And Senegal and the Gambia, they knew. They were proud of it, and they were, you know, they would talk about it. You know.
I want to take a listen to one of your things. It's from my Bluegrass Heart 2022 album, Sour Grapes. Maybe set that up for us, and we'll take a quick listen to that.
Sour Grapes. So this album is the first bluegrass record I had done in about, I think it was 20 years, maybe something like that. Maybe 23 years. And so I had a lot of tunes sitting around back when I was writing tunes and thinking bluegrassically back in the 80s. I still had a ton of tunes from back then that I'd never done anything with, including I would pick up an instrument I didn't play that well and try to write something. So I got a really nice mandolin, and I started writing a few mandolin tunes. Maybe I had four or five of them. And this is one that had been sort of sitting back there. And then when I met Sierra and Dominic Leslie, I thought, well, you know, this would be a fun thing to have them play together, because it would take my song out of the vault and get heard before I forget it and it's gone forever, but also put it in the hands of some people that can really play the instrument. You hear Dominic and Sierra trading back and forth. And then at the end, I asked Sierra to do what only she can do, because she's got these tiny little fingers. And I asked her to play in the extremely high range. And a perceptive listener will hear some supersonically high mandolin playing later in the piece, the last time through.
Well, let's take a listen to it. This is going to be Sour Grapes from my Bluegrass Heart, Bela Fleck. Thank you.
You want fries with that?
Yeah.
And that was Sour Grapes on the Bluegrass Heart with Bela Fleck. And you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
So, like, at first I was transported to this Mediterranean place, and then I was drawn into, like, a very animated conversation. So you explaining it to me made sense as to why I wrote those notes down, you know, because I just felt like I was in a conversation, very excited one.
But also, there's a lot of influence from David Grisman, who is a great mandolin player who had music, and is still around, called Dog Music. And he wrote a lot of stuff that had some of that sound. So I was also very influenced by his playing, as well as a guy named Andy Statman, who's also a great player, who plays with more klezmer music and stuff like that. So all that stuff kind of works on the mandolin.
Now, your current project, which you released in February, that Esther did in the introduction, is your Salute to Gershwin. But tell us about a little bit of your background of Gershwin and Rhapsody in Blue and how that became your album.
Sure. This is go back to the old days time. But for me, I was, I can't exactly pinpoint the date. But certainly after I had heard the banjo, I'm thinking maybe I was around 7. My uncle used to take me and my big brother to a movie theater called the Thalia that played the old movies, and you could go see the Marx Brothers or you could go see Singing in the Rain or things like that. But one day they had a show called Rhapsody in Blue, and it was the story of George Gershwin, very romanticized. I just loved it. I walked out of that in love with George Gershwin, and, you know, sad because he dies in it, as he did in real life. I think he was 38 when he passed, some kind of brain situation, horrible. But think of what might have come out of that guy if he'd had lived to a ripe old age, you know. But at any rate, I was always very impressed by the story of him writing that piece so fast. And as years went by, I would always check in with it. And when I started to learn the banjo, I started trying to do things that weren't done that much on the banjo. That was a natural. I started trying to mess around with it. And it was just too hard. I couldn't do it, you know. And over the years, I kept coming back to it and thinking, is there a way I could do something with this? That's just too hard. The piano part is just insanely complex. And it was like, I love it, but I'm not, you know, no. But then around pandemic time, suddenly I had time. And so I got a version from it for actually a friend of Abigail's, who she went to Colorado College with, who had written a book about it, which is basically a dissertation about the many ways Rhapsody has been played and the story of the piece and all about Gershwin and rearranging his music. And so it really gave me sort of wings to go ahead and explore it further. And he actually helped get me a computer file with the music on it so I could take the piano part and look at it in notation and pull it onto a banjo and see what was possible. And over the course of the pandemic, I would work on a measure a month or a couple of weeks, then I drop it, and then I come back. Oh, see, where did I get to? I got up to the 40th measure. Hey, maybe I'll keep going. I never thought that I was going to really get through it. It was more of a thought exercise, something impossible and epic to try for fun while I had this time. But then I mentioned it to the CEO of the Nashville Symphony, who I had a friendship with, and he had asked me to sign a CD for somebody. And he said, oh, great, we'll put it on the opening show in the Nashville Symphony for the big gala. I was like, oh, my gosh. And I was like, well, okay. And then I realized, you know, I'm just going to have to start simplifying and really making this work, because I can't make an impossible banjo part that only works in the computer. It has to be something that I can really play. And that's when I started really attacking it. And once I realized that I was going to be able to play it by September, by hook or by crook, I realized I better record it while I can play it, because 3 months later, I won't be able to play it. It's that kind of a rock you push up the hill when you're doing a piece like this. It's really hard. It's really new to you. And you just bust your butt and then you land it and then you're done. You know, you stop and the rock rolls back down the hill. So in this case, once I realized I was going to be doing it, I was going to be recording it, it suddenly dawned on me that it was the 100th anniversary of the piece. And it would be a great thing to get out in time for that. It'd be a neat moment for me, especially since I loved the piece my whole life. So that's what I did. And then I was like, well, what are you going to do? How are you going to fill out this record? And I got the potentially horrible idea that Rhapsody in Bluegrass was, there might be something there. And I hated the idea, but it kept coming back to me because I thought it could be a really cheesy yeehaw version of Rhapsody, and I didn't want that. But I started exploring it with some musicians, and come to find out it sounded kind of great. So we went ahead and did that, and now I was up to 30 minutes of music on the record, because Rhapsody is only 18 minutes. And then I started thinking about, well, I did this, so, you know, I've already shown that I'm willing to do anything. My class is no longer an issue. We know I have none. That's when I started thinking about the blues idea. That's when I asked my friends Sam Bush, Jerry Douglas, and of course Victor Wooten on the bass to take a pass at it and see what we could come up with. So it turned out well. Then I learned a couple of Gershwin solo piano pieces to fill out the record.
Well, let's take a listen on the Rhapsody in Blue, which released in February 12th. We're going to listen to Rhapsody in Blues. Thank you. And that was Bela Fleck, Rhapsody in Blues, on his Rhapsody in Blue album that was released in February 12th and is still available and out there in the world.
Brand new.
So creative. I mean, my gosh.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a wow.
Still available. Everything's available now, right? Forever and ever and ever.
About the cover art, do you have input in that?
I did. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's fabulous.
So that came from a poster when I had a very big show with my Bluegrass Heart, which was the Bluegrass band, where I had almost everybody, well, not everybody, but a ton of musicians from that project went to and played at Carnegie Hall. It was Sam Bush, Billy Strings, Chris Thiele, Sierra Hull, Michael Cleveland, Stuart Duncan, and Edgar Meyer. It was just a who's who. It was a great big gig. So we made a poster for it, and I loved it. It had the Statue of Liberty with the New York skyline and holding a banjo. And so they sent me all these designs for the album cover, and I kept saying, you know, I want something kind of like that poster. And finally I said, after they kept sending me things, I want that poster. That's the look. That is the story of this record. And so they finally took that artwork and sculpted it to fit a record cover. And I feel like when you find an image like that, it's a really special thing. There's a tendency right now to sort of move through things really fast. Oh, well, we already used that for this show. I'm like, well, this is record's going to be out for a lot longer than that show. That show's already over. This is it. So I love that cover. I really do. Thank you for liking it.
It really is like a piece of art. I mean, in and of itself. So it's in preparation for the show, you know, and doing the things that I do for the video promo, I was already looking at that and saying, oh, yeah, we can use that. We do a 30-second video promo for every show we do. So.
Oh, nice.
Yes.
And I can't wait for the vinyl when it's going to be big.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Didn't I see that was pressed in blue? Or was that Rhapsody?
I think it is going to be pressed in blue. I haven't seen it yet. And the funny thing is,
beautiful.
I don't listen to my own stuff. At a certain point, like, I'm moving on to the next thing, and occasionally I go take a look backward. But usually when I'm involved in creating a record, I'm so in it and I'm working on it, like, probably for a good year plus into it. And then I get into the post-production part where, you know, checking the test pressing, checking the audio for the CD, trying every process we can to, you know, make it sound big and full in the mastering process. And then after that, I need a break.
Oh, sure.
Like, I'm done, you know. So then hopefully, when I get back to it a couple of years later, I hear it on the radio, or someone's, you know, wants to ask me about something, or on a very rare occasion, I'll go back and listen to something. And I'm usually happy to hear it, and I'm glad I spent all that time, you know, working on it.
Is there something you are wanting to explore in music that you have yet to do? I mean, something that you say, gee, I really like to do. What is that?
Yeah, the next boulder to push up that mountain.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I tend to find boulders to push, but right now I'm working on some music with some great Latin musicians. It doesn't almost matter what it is, as long as it's good and I have to push myself to get there, because, like, I started working on some of these pieces that I'm learning for this new project, and I started out, it was like, I could just not sound good on it, and I worked on it, and I worked on it, and then the next day I worked on it and did not sound good on it. And I go, why am I doing this? I'm just not going to be good at this. And then the third day I started sounding good on it. I was like, then all of a sudden I was proud and I was glad I spent all that time. But for the first few days I was, that process is something you have to be okay with. If you want to get better or learn something new, you have to be okay with sounding bad till you get there. And when a lot of people, when they get to a point where they're sounding good, they want to stop, because it's uncomfortable to sound bad when you're a professional musician. But for me, I think I'm not comfortable unless I've at least recently done something hard and figured out how to do it on the banjo, because for some reason that turns my crank, and it makes me care and makes me still love to play music. So right now when I got the first few minutes of this piece, I started out by recording it and working on my banjo part till I could figure out how to make it sound right with the other musicians. I'm so proud. I was like, now I know I can make this thing work. Now I've got another few days ahead of me, but at the other end of it, when I meet up with these guys, I'm going to know how to play it, and we're going to be able to do something really good that shows the banjo off in a unique way. And that turns my crank.
Doing the compositions for everything, is it a spontaneous process, or is it more that kind of struggle that you were talking about? I'm sure it's a combination of both, but...
Yeah, composing is different than, like, technically learning to play something. In a way, the process I just explained to you kind of is composing. When you've got a set piece that's already been recorded and you're trying to figure out your place in it, I'm basically composing a banjo part, but I keep listening back and seeing how it works with the other parts and finding, you know, what I could do that would add something and not play something someone's already done, but add a new voice. Composing is, I always say, it's part inspiration and part craft, because you can come up with a lot of great ideas and great little melodies and rhythmic ideas or harmonic moves, and those usually come in a flash. you know, you just pick up an instrument or you sit down or you just start humming something and then there it is, just this little idea. But building something like that into a great tune or a concerto or, you know, a completed piece of music, a completed artistic offering requires both the inspiration and the craft of knowing how to take that and build on it. Keep right. coming back to that same piece over and over again until it's over. And you get those gimmies. Sometimes you wake up and you come up with a whole tune and it just pops out and it's like, boom.
Wow.
It's done. And other times you spend your, you know, years and you keep coming back to it and you can't figure out how to resolve it and make it work. And then one day it does. It took those years to resolve it. So I'm comfortable with that both of those processes are good. And, you know, just like getting paid, you know, sometimes you get paid a ton of money for something that took no effort, and sometimes you get paid nothing for things that take you years. It's just kind of like that's life, right?
It's so true. It's the same with poetry.
Sure.
Oh, I bet. I bet.
And you're listening to our guest today, Bela Fleck, on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM. Your upcoming project, which hasn't been released yet, it's coming out May 10th, is something which I think is very special. It's called Remembrance with about Chick Corea, and we are going to listen to Cut's Remembrance, but tell us a little bit about that project.
Yeah, I had a great relationship with Chick Corea. He was my hero musically, but a wonderful person to be with, you know, made a lot of incredible music, had a life of invention. And I was fortunate enough to hear him when I was young and impressionable, and it got in. A lot of what I do was highly influenced by him, among other people. It could be Charlie Parker too, Miles Davis, it could be Bach, it could be all kinds of things, the Beatles, but he was a very formative influence. And then come to pass, I end up getting to play music with him, and we had a duet that toured and made records together. We made a couple of albums, and we played together for about, I'm going to say about 15 years, although I'm not exactly sure that's right. And we became dear friends, and he was a constant influence and also a bar to try to rise to, because he had so much ability in areas that I didn't, languages he could speak musically that I was not capable of yet. And he, you know, kind of pointed me the way just by being himself and often showing me things. So we went out on tour the last time, I think it was 2019, and we'd been playing a lot of the music that we'd already been doing for a long time. We'd get together and go a tour. Instead of learning new music, we just play the new music and play it different, as he was very comfortable doing. And me too, I didn't want to do it the same. But this tour, I said, hey, Chick, I'm going to bring some new tunes. I think it's time for some new tunes. And he said, okay, well, I'm going to bring some new tunes too. And so we showed up on this tour and we played, I think it was a couple weeks of shows. And at the end of it, we had like 9 new things that we had never played before. And at the end of it, I said, hey, Chick, I'll come down to Florida anytime and we can record these things at your house. And he had a little studio set up and a great piano. And banjo is really easy to record in those kinds of spaces. But he said, no, we just did record it. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, Bernie's been recording all the shows on multitrack, and you're the producer, so go listen and come back to me and tell me if didn't we get it. I think we got it. I think it'll be better this way than if we sat at home and did it. So I said, okay, I hope I'm going to be up to snuff. I know you are. And it took me again to the pandemic. This was my other pandemic project to like sit down and start going through these shows and listening to all the new takes and putting them up against each other. And eventually I realized to my great joy that we really did get this stuff. We really played it well, and there were a lot of inspired moments, and it was all well recorded. And so I started sending Chick, hey, I think we played this tune really good in this town. What do you think? And he'd check off each tune and prove it. Sometimes I'd give him a couple of different nights and say, because that was my job. I was the producer. He had decided. So I'd send him what I thought were the best ones. He would often choose the one I thought was the best, and then we'd go ahead and finish it up, mix it. So then on one day I got a note from him or a call from him, and he said, hey, I'm sending you some music, just play on it and send it back to me. This was during the pandemic. We were just all at home and he was bored. So he sent me this new tune, and I think it was called Latin Tune. That's all we could know to call it, or Chick One or whatever. And I played a banjo part to it, sent it back to him. He said, okay, great, now you send me one. And so I wrote a tune and played it as if he was playing what I imagined he'd be playing, with space for him to solo and along to a click just to make sure it was in time. And different clicks to different beats that I thought it should be for different parts of the song. And I sent it off to him, and he sent it back to me a few days later, and it was like he'd done this amazing Chick Corea piano part to it. And then that started going. So by the time it got to be about November, we had quite an album in the can between these new live tracks that were all new music or pieces that had never been recorded before, and these new pieces. And he'd signed off on everything, and And then he died unexpectedly. And he had about 2 months from finding out that he wasn't well to being gone. It was a very, very fast and very sad. And so at any rate, that's the album that we have to offer. This is, I think, the last album of his, you know, unreleased things. That there's been a number of things that have come out since he passed. Some very, very nice music. I think this one's a very unique look at Chick Corea. And I'm really proud that we got to a new level with our duet, you know, after many, many years of building and growing a certain thing, we went to the next thing. And that's what we would have been going out and playing this year and next year if he was still with us.
Really precious process.
Yeah, it was an amazing thing. I'm still in shock that I ever got to play with him or know him at all. But, you know, he had my son Juno in his lap and playing piano together and, you know, at backstage. And he was part of our family by the end, and us with his. And it was a very unexpected turn of events and very beautiful.
Well, Bela, we unfortunately are out of time. And what we're going to do is play out with Remembrance, with your collaboration with Chick Corea. Bela Fleck has been on Art in the Air with us. We'll be in the area of, like, Skokie and toward the end of April. You can look at the schedule at your website. We appreciate you coming on Art of the Air, sharing your musical journey and background and music with us.
I got to add one thing before you cut me, before you pull the plug, which is, and thank you for all of that. Abigail Washburn is my wife and one of my collaborators. We didn't talk about her at all, although ostensibly that was the reason for the interview, but check her out. She's a goddess, and our duo is really a lovely meeting of banjo thought and her beautiful voice. So there's that too.
We'll be featuring her in our next show. Thank you so much for being on Under the Air.
Yeah, completely wonderful. Thank you. Thank you.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operation for Lakeshore Public Media, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker, and for WVLP, Walt Reitinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air. Show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world.